talk is kind of about taking some of these old ideas, right, from the immersive and putting it into actual hardware. Our team has multiple dimensions, both in terms of nationality and in terms of interests of its members. We have two mathematicians that collaborate with us, one from Korea, Sun Ha Kwon, and the other originally from Germany, Patrick Beyer. He was attending the beginning of this workshop, but unfortunately I needed to come back to teach classes. And then we have a strong hardware design team, two members of which are here in the audience, helping me out with preparation of slides for this talk, Zafranc and Shama Krishna, and Khalil, who recently defended his master thesis on this topic. And then we have a group of software engineers who help us with various verification experiments with power experiments regarding use of these factoring methods in actual hardware. I'll show by now, after several talks during this workshop, everybody is familiar with the idea of breaking RSA 1024, it was mentioned multiple times that the best method to do it is a number field sieve, which has these four major steps: polynomial selection, relation collection step, linear algebra, and square root. Our earlier effort was helping speed up linear algebra steps. Presented this work at Sharks 2005 in Paris, and then starting about a year ago, we concentrated on the second part of the relation collection step, which deals with factoring some intermediate numbers in the range of 200 bits, 350 bits from the second site of seeding. Here the primary method, which is used in this factoring of these size of numbers, that are already known to consist of only relatively small factors up to 2 to the power 40. This method is ECM, and we presented the implementation of this method in FPGAs at Sharks 2006. In this workshop, we show some additional results regarding ECM method, as well as extension of this method to two other special purpose methods, P-1 and Rho. Our work builds on the previous effort by the team, including members from Germany, Slovakia, some of them probably working in other countries. Majority of half of this group is here in the audience or attending the workshop in previous days. Our talk, today's talk, is the most relevant to related to the Wednesday talk by Rainer, who presented the architecture for this post-seeding step. Called norm factoring, also called, was referred here during this lecture as co-factoring. Rainer presented this architecture based on the ECM functional unit. This architecture is very much similar to some of the previous designs done independently. This block, this architecture, is very similar to what we, our group, implemented in actual hardware using PHDL. Our effort is to bridge the gap between high-level design and actual implementation. So implemented this entire portion in the HDL. We verified it experimentally and provided detailed estimates of speed and area for FPGAs and ASICs. Mm. The special focus of our group is comparison among three major technologies, the implementation in software using Pentium chips, the implementation in FPGAs with two possible platforms, and the implementation to ASICs. In terms of these FPGA platforms, we use one platform specifically for prototyping. This platform is relatively expensive, so it's not cost efficient in terms of final factoring, but provides many benefits in terms of prototyping, because it allows use of high-level programming languages such as C to describe hardware. And then we started the initial plans for the project of porting our design to Copacabana with collaboration with Joachim and other members of the extended team. Mm. So factoring 101, I don't want to repeat much from what was said during this workshop, and certainly this group doesn't need this introduction. Let me just focus on some of these methods that have not been covered that much even during this workshop, and these include the special purpose method that work very well for small numbers, but not that efficient for general or same type of numbers, but are good for numbers that includes small factors. We hope that these numbers would help us to find these small factors with the better ratio of probability of success to the execution path. These methods include Poiseuille's raw p minus 1 elliptic curve. I'll start from this short description of the raw method, and then I would like to show some similarities between p minus 1 and elliptic curve method. Mm-hmm. Poiseuille's raw method is a method based on the birthday paradox, which is very well known to you. If there are 23 people which are here, then in a room, or even if they are not, enjoying LA outside, there's still more than 50% probability that the birthdays of these two people fall on the same day of the year. We still have 24 people. Based on the same principle, the raw method creates a sequence, a very simple sequence described by this equation, xi plus 1 is equal to xi squared plus 1 modulo n, where n is a number we are trying to factor. Is assumed to contain a relatively small factor, such as in this case, 97. Then if we look at this sequence, since it's done modulo n, and n is a relatively large integer, but there is relatively small primes, but the numbers will start repeating quickly. At the same time, if we take the numbers from this sequence modulo small factor of 97, then the chances grow. Because this sequence of these values are reduced, modulo 97 would be only in the range between 0 and 96. And here, based on the birthday paradox, already after 10 iterations, we are likely to find two members of the sequence that are equal to each other. Here in this somewhat artificially chosen example, that happens even quicker. So you can see that already the fourth component of the sequence is the same as the first. And since it's a deterministic sequence, afterwards, these values start repeating themselves. If you present these values in a somewhat graphical forms. So we go from x1, which is 2, and 5, 26, 95, back to 5. You can see that this graph forms a template of a letter Ra and Greek letter, and from there comes the name of this method, Ra method. Now, if you find two components that are equal to each other, modulo this small factor Q, and Q divides the difference between these numbers. And since Q also divides M, Q will divide greatest common divisor, and this way, by computing this greatest common divisor, we find the factor of 97. Now, in general, the sequence graphically represented would look somehow like that, and we don't know the period of this loop at the head of the Ra letter, but this we know that this value kind of on average would fall somewhere in the vicinity of the square root of p, where p is a factor we are trying to find. And this way, if we try different differences between the components of the sequence, then we'll be able to locate the large value of the period. Kind of graphically representing that is that we can imagine the rectangle in which in each column we have a difference of components of the sequence where the difference of indices is equal to 1. Then in the next column we have a difference of indices being 2, then 3, and so on. And if we create a product that includes one component from each column, okay, let's say we go through the diagonal, then we are able to cover all possible differences between indices of component up to a certain maximum, which is equal to the number of iterations of this method. Okay, so that's a kind of a simple version of the method where we try to minimize area and memory. This version is referred as a Floyd's method. In this case, we just need two registers. We create these two sequences. The first one we go by one, and the other by two. The result of the difference between the components, subsequent components, keep increasing in trace one and two and three. We accumulate these values with some computations that are optional, can be eliminated because they are covered by these subsequent values that are accumulated in parameter D. Somewhat improved version comes from Brand, where we somewhat jump around. So some rows are not included at all, but in different rows we'll take the two components from two columns and from four columns. That allows us to save some of the intermediate computations and minimize the execution time by 24%, and we exploited this feature. Then the other two methods that we implement are P-1 ECM. I'd like to just show the pseudocode of these methods and show that assuming that we kind of synchronize the notation, they look almost identical to each other. In P-1 method, we take four parameters, n being the number to be factored, a is arbitrary integer, typically smaller than n, and be chosen, for example, to be equal to 2 to simplify computations, and then we have two smoothness bounds. These bounds, the greater the bounds, the more computations we need to do, but also the greater probability of success. The algorithms would consist of some pre-computations that are completely independent of n, include the computation of value of k, which is a product of prime powers pi to the power ei, where ei is the largest exponent such that pi to the power ei is smaller than our first smoothness bound b1. Then we take all these primes up to B1. Then the value of Q naught is computing simply as A to the power K modulo X. We do a simple modular exponentiation with somewhat unusually large value of K, which here you can see that's not reduced by any value here. Okay, and then the result we subtract 1 and compute greatest common divisor of this value with n, and if that is greater than 1 and different than n, we found the factor. I can see from this slide that kind of the main computations that require most effort and which will be moving to hardware is just this part of modular exponentiation. Then there is a phase 2, which allows us to extend our chance of success, in which we take primes between B1 and the second smoothly bound B2, and take the result from the first phase, take these to the power corresponding to these all primes from this range, subtract 1 and accumulate the result. At the end, we calculate greatest common divisor of the n. Once again, this greatest common divisor can be done as a part of post computations at same software. And this part, which mostly consists of exponentiations and multiplications, is done in hardware. Here is a simple numerical example of a product of two primes, which is A equal to 2, bounds B1 equal to 20, K, and this as a product of these powers. We compute Q naught and the greatest common divisor. And that's about to the product 1361. Why does the method work? It's pretty much based on the simple the Fermat theorem. If Q minus 1 is our number is equal to is consists of small primes, so these primes divide K. If we take A to the power K, that's like taking A to the power Q minus 1. Times m, and so in this case, from the Fermat theorem, this value reduces to 1. So we can very easily see that Q is a divisor of K to the power K minus 1. Now, ECM algorithm can be described almost identical form with additional two parameters, which is curve and point on the curve. Now the difference is that during main computation K, computation of K is identical to computing K the same way as before. And now the difference that during main computations we don't do modular exponentiation, but instead we do scalar multiplication. So we take the point on the curve, which is our initial parameter here provided, and we multiply this point by our vector K. And then we do a similar post-computation as before. Similarly, in the second phase, we once again take primes between B1 and B2 and take the result from the previous phase and multiply by each of these primes and accumulate a portion of the result in the form of the Z coordinate. And then once again, the post-computations are very similar. A small example showing a curve. This curve has a number of points that happens to be the product of small primes. So if we are lucky to choose a curve of this form, that a number of points has small divisors, these divisors divide our specially constructed K, then we have a guarantee that K multiplied by point on the curve, P0, is sub m times number of points on the curve times P0, number of points multiplied by value of the point leads to the point of infinity, which is like 0 in operations on the curve. And that's from that we have the dependence that ZQ is equal to 0. It divides that. Okay, so now how would we combine these three methods together? We can take the advantage of the fact that the majority of the computations are very similar, and combine these methods together, let them share a lot of hardware resources. And one possibility is, let's say we have 200 bit number, we apply first p minus one method, which would have a shorter execution time compared to ECM. That would, let's say, split our result to a 40 bit number, 160 bit number, and then this 40 bit number is likely to, if it's not a prime, it's likely to contain two very small numbers that can be found by the raw method. 160 may still contain the small primes, so one of them can be, or more can be found by the raw method, and then afterwards we apply multiple iterations of ECM methods. Here we have the flexibility that we can choose a different curve each time. With the choice of parameters, we kind of went according to the recommendations from previous work by the groups from Bonn and Bochum. And in the ECM method, we have this dependent P1, P2, increased probability of success. But at the same time, execution time, we're trying to maximize the probability of success to execution time ratio. That, for our values of primes, 200 bit numbers and 40 bit factors, leads to this choice of parameters, P1 960, P2 57,000. We assume the use of the same parameters for ECM. And for the raw method, we chose the number of iterations to be about 8,000. That was chosen to approximately have the same execution time as a single iteration of ECM method, with the larger probability of success for small primes up to 2 to the power 26. So now how does it all look in hardware? We have multiple factoring units working in parallel on an FPGA. They're all controlled by the same control unit. So all these units will be executing exactly the same instructions at the same time, but with different data. In our current design, these units are independent for ECM P-1 and RAW, but in the future work, the idea is to combine them together so we can reuse the same hardware, especially in case of ASICs, to do computations involving all these three methods. There are some pre-computations and post-computations that are done, assumed to be done on the host computer. So not everything needs to be done here. And we can increase the amount of area that can be used for major computations. The major building blocks in all three methods is a Montgomery multiplier. We chose the design performs operations on the entire length of the operand every clock cycle, since we have relatively medium size of operands, 200 bits in one case, rational side, and 350 for algebraic side. That's doable. And actually compared it to a proper design, and we got a better ratio of speed to area. This design served us actually well. The focus was in our optimization criteria is to make all the execution units to work to be busy on most of the time. So we want to cover this entire rectangle that represents area of the chip and time. And if we have all these units, majority of the sharing is busy all the time, then the most likely we'll get the best result. So that led to the following execution unit. In case of raw and P-1, we assume that it's the best to have just one multiplier and one error subtractor working parallel. Then in case of ECM, we can have two multipliers, the majority of time busy all the time, and then one under subtract working parallel to these multipliers. Okay, so here I'm getting to the first batch of results. These are results in terms of the maximum number of units per FPGA device for different methods. We took one of the largest devices from the Spartan 3 family, and then one of the largest from the Vertex 2 family, and you can see that they have a comparable capacity, and the difference comes primarily from the number of multipliers here in the ECM, since the multiplier takes a large percentage of the area, and approximately twice as many units within these four rods, P-1, compared to ECM. Now, in terms of clock frequency, it appears that all of these units can work at very comparable frequencies, around 100 megahertz. There is a drop of frequency when we go from one unit on an FPGA to maximum number of units, but we try to keep this drop as small as possible. Then, if we look at the number of runs per second, here we have the first comparison with microprocessors. So we compare two families of Xilinx FPGAs versus Pentium 4, 2.8 gigahertz. In case of Pentium implementation, we use the highly optimized implementation, GMP-ECM, by Zimmermann and many other collaborators, show that we believe it's one of the best, if not the best, software implementation available. It includes also implementation of P-1 and RAW software, which was done by our group, but it's kind of hard to go wrong with this one. So what you can see, you can look at the speed up versus software, that's an important parameter. Well, Vertex devices give us a speed up in the range of 10 to 11, and then the Spartan devices, low-cost devices, give us a speed up around 7 to 8. Now, there is a possibility to improve these results by a trick that was proposed by Reiner. In Wednesday talk, he suggested to go with more aggressive parameters of the ECM method that could also apply to P-1. It appears that if we go with B1, B2, we lower these numbers. We don't lose, based on this experiment, we don't lose much in terms of the probability of finding prime spectra. But we can improve the speed actually by a factor of 3.5. That will cover apply both to software and hardware, so the ratio remains the same for engine 8 to 11. Here are some of results for comparison of number of operations per cost for $100, and here you can clearly see the advantage of low-cost families. If we compare Spartan 3 versus Vertex 2, we have the advantage by a factor of 16 in terms of the number of operations we can get per $100, and that transfers also to the newer two families, Spartan 3E and Vertex 4. So from here, the conclusion is let's use these low-cost FPGAs to build actual trackers. Okay, now this semester our university was offering for the first time the course on VLSI design automation, and as a part of this course, members of our groups within the computer engineering program were required to do the ASIC implementation of the chip. So we used this opportunity to implement our ECM and ROC cores. The process was the same as the one assumed by Reiner. On 0.14 micron, 13 nanometers. We use TSMC library with some memory cells, and the tools are based on the Synopsys package. So that led to this kind of layout. You can see on the left side, you can see local memory show, in which case the number of units is 24, so you have 24 sets of memory corresponding to each unit, and then we have global memory coming through the entire chip, vectorial computations take place in this part. And the interesting thing is that you take the size of this ASIC chip as being laid out, it takes and compare it to the size of the vertex to 6,000, the area of this ASIC chip is only 1 out of 51 of the area of the vertex. So FPGA require much more area because of your computer capability. So you have kind of a pure gain in terms of the area by a factor of 51. That's raw. For ECM, we need kind of more communication with these cells, so these memories are kind of more sparse. That was required by the tool. The ratio is somewhat smaller, but still at the level of about 25 with 13 ECM units on the chip. In terms of clock frequency, we have the first estimates. These are not final results yet. The team is still working on other optimizations, but the initial indication is that the frequency will double, approximately the double for all methods. From here we have additional gain by a factor of 2. So if you combine these two gains from area and from frequency, we are getting improvement in terms of the number of raw and TCM computations per second using the same chip area by a factor of 100 in terms of raw and by a factor of 50 in case of TCM. The TCM result could be still possibly improved by first making the device smaller, better utilization of this area between memories, and also working on the frequency. Okay, the other implementation that we developed over the last couple of months, that was the effort of one student, Huang, who was working since the last shark, during the last semester, on the implementation using SRC6 recomparable computer. So what is this machine? It's a relatively bulky machine. It looks like a vending machine. Much you can get a Coke, you press a button, you get a Coke. But what it includes inside, it includes two Pentium chips and two big Xilinx FPGAs versus two 6000. All operate. The FPGAs, the Pentium chips run at 3 gigahertz. The Xilinx devices run at 100 megahertz. And then you have fast communication between these two boards. One is sort of traditional microprocessor board, the other is FPGA board that can communicate with a speed of about 1600 megabytes per second. Multiple units can be placed within these chassis, so these can be scaled, can have multiple boards, but of course you need to pay extra money, and even the basic configuration in this machine is quite costly. A range of $50,000 to $100,000. So now what's a programming model for this machine? You have actually your program distributed into three parts. There is a main part, a main function, main.c that runs on the microprocessor. It's written in NCC. Then you have a portion that will be running on FPGA, but will be described in C, not exactly of a full feature of C, but some subset of NCC that is referred as MAPC by FPGA. And then you can call within these MAPC functions, you can call macros which somebody, or you by yourself, or somebody else for you, wrote in DHDL, and these macros are stored in the library. Now notice that what happens if a function written MAPC calls the same macro twice, but results in two different instantiations of this macroing hardware that can work in parallel. And the arguments of these calls define the connections between these macros and hardware. So as a result, you have a situation that you have your program distributed in three parts. The first part is a C function for microprocessor, then there is a C function for map, meaning for retrofield processor, and then you have VHDL macro. So you have also two boundaries. The first boundary is between execution on a microprocessor by execution on FPGA, and then there is a second boundary that is a boundary between high-level language like C and the hardware description language like VHDL. Okay, so you know, we believe that writing in high-level language is simpler, so it leads to advantages in terms of development time, but at the same time, we may face some penalty in terms of performance. Now, everybody's familiar with this hierarchy of functions in elliptic curve operations. So in case of ECM, its major operation is really KP, plus some pre-computation, post-computation. So KP would be constructed out of point addition, point doubling, and then at the bottom you have operations in this case, ring of numbers modulo n. Now, how can we distributed between these different levels, between these three different descriptions. So the first approach, which is certainly most efficient in terms of speed, would be to describe everything, starting from KP down in the HDL, and then just call these functions using very small MAPC function, and that this MAPC function will be called from main C. So that's one approach. That we've taken since we already had everything implemented in the HDL. And then the second approach would be to allow computer scientists let's say take over some portion of the implementation and rely only on the library that includes functions at the bottom of the hierarchy. So all these two levels, top level and medial level, are now described in the C, subset of C, that is translated by the compiler into hardware. So it was interesting to see how much improvement are we getting in terms of development time, and how much improvement do we get, how much penalty do we pay in terms of speed. The first answer to the first question is it was kind of hard to tell, because the students were familiar with the HDL, but not familiar with writing in a subset of C with some restrictions, but we kind of approximated the way that it took the students, three students, one semester to work on PhDL, and then one student to work for one semester on the C version. So it's a factor of three in terms of efficiency. Right. Now, what penalty do we pay in terms of speed? Here you can see. This graph here is VHDL version only, and here is MAPC version that calls just VHDL macros, and you can see that the factor is around 2, it's really 1.9, so we are losing efficiency 90%, and probably the majority of that comes from the control unit operation that are not described that efficiently in C versus VHDL. There's also some penalty with calling the macro from C versus VHDL. Additionally, unfortunately, you pay additional price in terms of the area, because control units also becomes bigger, and some of the execution units become bigger, so you can fit only 5 of such units on Vertex FPGA versus 9 units in the VHDL version. So to give you some idea where does these penalties come from, here's the innocent looking operations where you assign values of 16 variables to A in different portions of your C program, and the programmer can do it 100 times and you don't care, but apparently in hardware, all translates to hardware, you need to have this big multiplexer that would somehow route these 16 sources to register A. Another thing that you need to be aware of, that I mentioned previously, but you call a function from C twice, and you know, inertially, if you have microprocessor, this function would use the same microprocessor unit to execute. But in MAPC, they can translate to different pieces of hardware on the FPGA. So to deal with the second approach, you need to have a certain design style where within a large loop, you can instantiate your macro only once, okay, and then you can flip, you need to flip the parameters that go to this macro by changing indices in this memory instantiations. Here, memory calls. So each time you call memory, you would be accessing a different location memory, which corresponds to different register in your bank. But here you have a bunch of ifs that would determine for each iteration of the loop which memory location you are referring to. If you are using the same memory for input to output, you know, that unfortunately creates a dependency. And instead of pumping data to the macro every clock cycle, the macro kind of tend to wait until everything is settled, the output comes back to memory, and that's not good. So the way to deal with that, you need to have really a different memory. You have a different memory bank for your input, different memory bank for your output. And then, you know, after you do some portion of computations, you come back. You know that there are no dependencies between input and output initially, so let the hardware exploit that. And then you just transfer output memory back to input memory to start the new set of computations. Okay, the bottom line is that in terms of the number of ECM operations per second, take into account both the penalty area and speed, you are losing by a factor of about 3.4 with the current implementation. But you know, on the better side, you are still better by a factor of 2 over software implementation. So it still may be used as a kind of proof of concept tool to make sure that, you know, first it's implementable, and secondly, you're getting some improvement at all versus microprocessor implementation. If you look at the number of lines of code the students need to write, in case of VHDL version, we need to write a lot of VHDL and very little C, and here it's kind of vice versa. You need to write some VHDL for these bottom level routines, but the number of lines drops from about 4,000 to 2,000, so by a factor of 2,000 lines, and instead you need to write about 1,000 lines of MAPC code. So you're trading 2,000 lines of VHDL versus 1,000 lines of C, which is not such a bad deal. C, it's easier to write and debug. Hmm. Now, if we run our design on real system, on SRC, here are some execution times, and kind of the straightforward approach is to do some general pre-computations independent of N, first of all, microprocessor, then do pre-computation on the microprocessor, transfer data, do computations in hardware on FPGA, then transfer data back, and then do post-computation, and then start another round of pre-computations, which are dependent on N. With this approach, you can see that the main computation take about 95%. That means that overhead associated with communication and post-computation pre-computation is less than 5%. And that's with 9 units on the chip. We can reduce this overhead to less than 1% in a simple trick in which we overlap computational microprocessor with computational FPGA, which are independent of each other. The pre-computations are kind of for the next cycles. The post-computations operate on results from the previous cycle, and that reduces overhead to less than 1%. Okay, so now the question is how would that translate to Copacabana, and we don't have the experimental results yet, but we have some estimations. What changes here is that now we have 120 FPGAs, 2 ECM units per FPGA, so a total of 240 ECM units. And the question is whether we can transfer data in time for one set of computations to complete, so whether we can completely overlap computations with transfer and post computation. And assuming that we keep the same frequency, the total execution time for phase one, phase two would be still 36 milliseconds. And that leads, after some computation of the amount of data we need to transfer in and out, to the conclusion that we need a speed of at least 1 megabyte per second. I think it's doable. If you look at the USB speed, USB 1.2, it's 1.5 megabytes per second. The USB 2, it's 60 megabytes per second. So that should be completely doable. And so similar as before, we can overlap operations. So after some initial pre-computation setup stage, we have the main computations on FPGA done in parallel with input-output, which takes kind of majority of the time to transfer data to these 240 units. And then we can also do pre-computation and post-computation at the same time on the microprocessor. Okay, so just to briefly conclude, we've demonstrated that the Hamming implementation gives us the advantage, and it's advantage not only in terms of speed, but also in terms of performance to cost ratio. If we count part-time devices, they are approximately the same cost, I mean less, but the cost of Pentium chips. So the result for Spartan devices would carry this advantage by factor of 8-10 versus microprocessors would carry, including cost. And then for ASICs, if we exclude the kind of the initial non-recurrent fabrication cost, we can get additional factor of 500 to 550 to 100. Then if we take this initial cost into account, everything depends how many units will we need, how many we fabricate, because all these costs would split between these multiple units. In terms of prototyping, it seems that SRC is a valid option, although there are problems related to the speed penalty. And then the best environment for final design is either based on low-cost FPGAs like Copacabana, or ASICs in case of high volumes, and if we need this additional speed up by a factor of 500, 550 to 200. Thank you very much.